The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we're going to conclude this final week of summer, or the unofficial summer at least, on a good note with two engaging guests. You will first hear from Jacqueline Fuller, the president of Google.org, who tells us that they approach philanthropy with the same mindset that Google approaches its business.
As Google.org, we very much have the culture of Google, which means that we are a launch and iterate kind of operation. And the idea there in Silicon Valley being that you gather the best data that you can, you make informed evidence-based decisions, but then you try things and you pivot and you try things and you pivot and you measure your results, you're transparent about those outcomes, and then you try new things. And so that's really the approach that .org took from the beginning.
And as we begin the new school year, we'll discuss something that is critical to improving graduation rates, and that's attendance, just showing up. Kinvolved is a company that has taken a holistic approach to fighting chronic absenteeism, and we'll speak to its co-founder and CEO, Miriam Altman.
One of the first things I observed when I was teaching was that kids just weren't showing up to school consistently. I had students who would miss a day of school here and there, kids who would chronically miss first period and so always miss their history class, other students who would be absent for a couple of weeks at a time for family vacations or other more severe issues, and then just, you know, the typical high school kid who would cut class here and there. And it just was a pretty tremendous, overwhelming problem.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 2nd. From 2007 through 2016, nonprofit employment grew by nearly 17%, while for-profit employment grew by less than 5%. After the recession, nonprofits added jobs at a rate that was nearly four times that for for-profit businesses. Paying employees to volunteer could be key to keeping millennial staff. Companies such as Starbucks, for example, are funding employees to spend half the week working at nonprofit organizations. The Texas financier, Edward Bass, gave Yale University $160 million this week to renovate and expand the 152-year-old Peabody Museum of Natural History. Wonder School, a platform that helps licensed educators and caretakers launch in-home preschools or daycares, just raised $20 million in financing. TechCrunch says the company aspires to be the Airbnb of daycare. It lets professional caregivers and teachers set up shop at home, while Wonder School handles the administration and logistics. A group of Catholics empowered to advise U.S. bishops on their handling of clergy sex abuse is accusing the bishops of loss of moral leadership and recommending that lay Catholics, like themselves, should henceforth be responsible for investigating clergy misconduct. The J.J. Watt Foundation has announced that the online fundraising campaign set up by the Houston Texans football star to assist people affected by Hurricane Harvey has raised a total of $41.6 million over the past year. It launched with a goal of just $200,000. And finally, a new app called Papa adds a little convenience to the caring economy, letting the elderly book time with a college student to help with errands or just hang out. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Jacqueline Fuller of Google.org right after this.
Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create more opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Follow them on Twitter at Upstart CoLab. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
One company that everyone is just fascinated by is Google. What is their business model? What's the secret of being so innovative? And how have they created such a fabulous workplace culture? Equally fascinating is their philanthropy and their approach to addressing some of the most vexing social problems in the world today. And we're fortunate to have with us this evening the president of Google.org, Jacqueline Fuller. Good evening, Jacqueline, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Denver.
You know, before we dig into the specifics of what Google.org supports and the social changes that you're seeking to cause, provide listeners with a brief overview of Google.org, your philosophy and approach to philanthropy.
Sure. Google.org is part of Google. We're Google's philanthropy. We're a team at Google. And the idea is to think about how can we use the best of Google? How can we bring the best of who we are as a technology company with 80,000 employees and make the most difference possible for some of these big challenges you were mentioning?
You know, so much of your leadership at Google.org has been informed by what preceded it. And if it's okay, I want to take a look back and understand some of those influences. Now, your father was a diplomat. You
yep.
grew up overseas, some in Germany, some in the Soviet Union. And you had designs on a career in international relations, specifically arms control. What caused you to pivot from that to philanthropy and helping those less fortunate?
Well, I've always been interested in human relations and policy. Arms control was particularly interesting because at the time I thought, you know, nuclear war is probably our biggest threat, and this is something I should really work on. So I dug into it, but as I looked around, I would go to these conferences and I would see, you know, there's a lot of wealthy, powerful people who are working on this problem because, you know, they're self-interested. It affects us all. It's going to affect rich and poor.
Great point.
So I thought it's very important, nuclear disarmament. I very much believe in it. But I should take my skills and talents and invest in an area where I'm going to have more impact. And that's where I became really attracted to thinking about issues of poverty and what is the evidence base? What are the solutions that work for something like poverty?
Mm-hmm. And you were volunteering at Watts out in L.A., weren't
That's
you?
Right. I was going to UCLA, yeah. and I was volunteering at Watts at a community center.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of this may have been influenced by your faith because you grew up in a very loving and moral family, but not a particularly rigid religious one, and you found Christianity as a teenager. Tell us about that.
That's right. So I grew up at West Point, the military academy, and mm-hmm. the cadets there would lead a Sunday school. And I started going to that because my parents thought, well, that's a nice moral influence on you. And so I think the original seeds were there. I was a part of Young Life as a teenager, as was my husband. And I think was just really struck by the relationships there, having adults who taught me about the love of Jesus and also invested in me, really cared for me in a deep way. So that was the beginnings of my faith.
Yeah. And you knew God loved the poor and
yes.
you wanted to do something about that.
Well, so that's the thing is, you know, I became a Christian at like 16 years old and I thought, well, I should read the Bible. And, you know, I started in Genesis and got really bogged down in Leviticus.
Oh, that's a slog.
And,
yeah.
It was a slog. And I just read it from beginning to end. And, you know, the biggest takeaway I had is that God desperately, desperately loves his people. And he especially loves the poor
mm-hmm.
and calls us all to think about the oppressed, the foreigner, and that we are responsible for creating communities that include everyone.
Well, if you were going to be concerned about the poor, you couldn't find a much better place than the Gates Foundation.
That's right.
Which was founded back in 2000. And how you went about landing that job, Jacqueline, is a story unto itself and also tells us a lot about you. Share that story with us.
Yeah, so the backdrop is that after college, I worked in the government for a couple mm-hmm. years. I got a master's degree from the Kennedy School at Harvard. But then I took a couple years to be a mom home with babies. And then when I was going back, I had read an article where Bill Gates talked about what he was going to do with his philanthropy. And he said, I'm going to give it to help the poorest of the poor. And I thought, I'm sold.
Bingo.
You need me. I want to help you, Bill. I want to help you.
I'm your girl.
I'm your girl. And so it was just starting up at the time. It really didn't have a presence. It was kind of in stealth mode. But from the article, it said that the office was above a pizza shop in Redmond, Washington. So I drove out to Redmond, Washington, and I drove around to all the pizza shops and looked for the ones with offices above them. And that narrowed it down to a couple. And then I went and looked at the mailboxes at the bottom and sort of through process of elimination. Okay, it's not the dentist. It's not to that mailbox. And I would go down there every day and I would put in my resume and my cover letter explaining how I could help them and why they needed to hire me. And they would email me back the rejections, yep. you know, day after day, day after day, day after day. And
this probably did your resume, right?
Yes. I redid my resume.
Maybe this one.
All right. Well, you don't need an M&E specialist, but what you really need is advocacy. So I, you know, tried different things. And then finally, this is a true story. Jack Ferris,
mm-hmm.
Who was one of the early employees, got back to me and said, I will meet with you for 15 minutes at Starbucks if you promise you will never bother us again. I was like, I've got a chance.
Oh, absolutely.
And he ended up hiring me.
Your break. Well, there you go. That's right. To write a brochure or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
They were hands-on philanthropists, weren't they?
Yes.
Bill and Melinda Gates. And you helped organize some of their trips to the developing world. Any of them particularly memorable?
Yeah. You know, one thing I really admire about Bill and Melinda Gates is that they take their philanthropy very seriously. They don't want to just hire an apparatus and, you know, tell them to run with it. They really wanted to inform themselves. So, for example, their biggest focus in the beginning was global health, still mm-hmm. still a major focus for them. And they realized, you know, what do we, an upper middle class white, you know, couple from Seattle, really know about global health? And so they approached with humility and they said, we're going to go to these countries. And so I helped organize those trips.
Yeah.
Learning trips, advocacy trips. And when we would go, they would very much, so we'd need to often meet with the you know, head of state, with the minister of health and all that, which were important meetings. But they also wanted to make sure, hey, I want to meet with the community health nurse in the clinic in Soweto, and I want to listen to her about immunization rates.
Yep.
I want to understand what she thinks. And so we would talk to everyone in the chain. We would talk to people in the community and really do that firsthand learning.
Yeah. And then you ended up living in India for a year, right?
That's right. I got hooked. I went with Bill Gates on his first trip ever.
Yeah.
We went to a slum clinic, actually, in India, in Delhi. And it's kind of ironic that I ended up moving back there with my family in 2004, 2005.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you care about philanthropy, working for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a pretty sweet place to be. You could really have some significant impact. So what motivated you to move from there over to the world of corporate philanthropy?
One of the things that I had seen with Bill and Melinda Gates is that they had been able to really, I think, lift the level and quality of philanthropy in the sense that they both wrote bigger checks, which is what most people talked about, but they also had a very deep and consistent seriousness of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a learning machine, right? They wanted to learn how to do better, be really thoughtful about outcomes. And, you know, I was really struck, if you look at all of the giving in America right now, it's north of $400 billion. But if you ask the question, well, what percent of that is coming from our companies, our corporations, it's less than 5%.
Mm-hmm. Most people don't realize that.
Yeah, 5%. And, you know, Larry Page, one of the founders at Google, has said, you know, most people will spend most of their time working for a company.
Yep.
And so if you think about how we're spending our time and our days and you talk to people, they really want to be part of an enterprise that is making a difference in the world, that's doing good. And so I think this area of corporate philanthropy was really interesting for me. I thought maybe it's an area where we could increase not only the amount being given, but also the seriousness of purpose and the outcomes.
And their seriousness of purpose was there right from the very outset, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was baked into the DNA of the company.
That's right. So Larry and Sergey, when they founded Google, you know, they came straight from graduate school. They were a couple of PhD students at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
They had never really worked for a company, either of them. And so when they were thinking about, well, what's the company I want to create? What's important to us about our culture? And part of that was building philanthropy in from the beginning. So before the company went public, in their letter from the founders, they said, we want to give 1% of our net profit to philanthropy, to Google.org.
It's pretty brazen when you got no profit.
That's
you know
right.
What I mean?
That's right.
So, and let me ask you this, just as an aside, if every company today gave 1% of net profits to philanthropy, how much more would that add to that $400 billion pie?
Well, in the U.S. alone, it'd be north of $60
billion. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So real money. And if you think, look, I think when you're talking about corporate philanthropy, you have something that the Gates Foundation doesn't. The Gates Foundation is the private money of Bill and Melinda Gates. But when you're talking about a company, you're talking about your employees. You're talking about your supply chain. You're talking about your brand and your reach. There's so many different aspects and assets that you can bring to the table.
Yeah, the products and everything else. It's just amazing. Well, they also said that they wanted to be an unconventional company. And I suspect that intention also carried over to its philanthropy. So let me ask you, how do you think Google.org is unconventional?
Well, as Google.org, we very much have the culture of Google, which means that we are a launch and iterate kind of operation. And the idea there in Silicon Valley being that you gather the best data that you can, you make informed evidence-based decisions, but then you try things and you pivot and you try things and you pivot and you measure your results, you're transparent about those outcomes, and then you try new things. And so that's really the approach that .org took from the beginning. I would say another way that we really reflect Google is that as an engineering company, mm-hmm. our strength is in technology. And so we try to think about how can we lean into technology and innovation, because it's an area a lot of funders lean out of.
Yes. Let me ask you this on that launch and iterate, which is so refreshing in so many ways, particularly when you contrast it with the world of philanthropy. Does that ever get a little challenging that you don't stick with anything for a long time or just keep on moving and moving and moving?
Yeah, definitely. I think, launch and iterate can help bring more innovation and more informed risk. You know, the danger is we're talking about human lives. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to be experimental to the point that it's detrimental either. And so recently, you know, on the consistency thing as well, recently Google as a company took a step back and looked at all of our social impact work across the board, not just Google.org, but, you know, things that are going on in some of our product teams and whatnot, and thought, hey, where are some areas we can really double down mm-hmm. over several years? And that's where the kinds of things that came to the surface, where we have deep, deep values and alignment and maybe some strengths, are things like education, mm-hmm. economic empowerment, inclusion, responding to crises very quickly. So those were areas that came to the surface for us.
Mm-hmm. How are decisions made at Google?
Well, I can speak to Google.org.
Yeah, Google.org, yeah. That's more than enough.
Google's culture, I will say, is very collaborative. I was told as I was coming in, you're going to be a level whatever, but don't worry, no one cares about levels. Mm. And there's some truth to that. We're not very hierarchical. Everyone will always want to know what's your evidence or data for something. So if you have an opinion, that's great. Voice it. Back it up. Back it up. Be prepared to back it up with data.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the employees. How does Google.org look at their employees? I mean, do you look for a cadre of them to dedicate themselves to the nonprofit arm? Or do you kind of tap into those employees where they are and bring them in as needed?
Our business model is to think of Google.org as a very small, agile, central team that helps to leverage our core strengths, which is, number one, our 80,000 employees. So how can we, if we think about an area that we want to work on, say criminal justice reform, and we think, okay, we absolutely want to invest resources to provide the oxygen that these innovators need, but how can we also bring alongside our Googlers, our employees, and especially those who have specific skill sets needed by these teams to operationalize their solutions?
Let's talk a little bit about what you just said a moment ago about taking a step back, because your CEO made a big announcement last year. It's $1 billion.
That's right.
Over 5 years. It's 1 million hours of volunteer time. And there are 3 major components to that. Just touch on each one of them and maybe some of the work you're doing in those areas.
So Sundar, our CEO, is very personally motivated for us to do philanthropy as Google.org and as a company. Mm. And he has really led the charge for us to think about, let's make multi-year commitments. Let's really look into the future and pick a few areas and stick with them. And so the $1 billion commitment was really around education and economic opportunity in particular, and thinking about how do we serve anyone who's been left behind, the most disadvantaged populations, and really help prepare people for the future of work. And then the million hours is really thinking about, okay, for our employees, we have things like Google Serve, which is where teams can all go out and volunteer together in the community. That is a great practice. You know, a good percentage of our employees participate in that. How can we take the step beyond that even mm-hmm. and commit more in-depth immersion-type experiences?
Well, let's take one of those, a future of work.
Sure.
Now, I guess by 2020, which is only 2 years away, about a third of people in the workforce will not have the required skills to get a job, which is that's a freight train coming down. What are some of the things you're doing in that arena?
Yeah, when we look at the future of work and look at the data, what's very clear is that we're going to have job changes, but more importantly, we're going to have a skills mix change. And so what that means for is that all of us, both, you know, students coming up and those of us in employment right now, we really need to think about life as lifelong learners mm-hmm. and to really be able to take advantage of upskilling so that we're prepared for where the job market is headed. And so we have looked at a few areas where we as Google Can help with, in particular, digital skills training. So the company has started a program called Grow with Google.
Yeah.
I was just in Reno, Nevada, which is where my heritage is.
Mm-hmm.
Five generations. That's right. Five generations, grandparents, cousins, everyone. And what we're really looking at is how can we help with online learning, which is accessible to anyone, for people to upgrade their skills, whether it's just, you know, very basic digital literacy, getting to know computers, getting to know basic spreadsheets, or whether that's more advanced, computer science, and thinking about things like becoming an IT support professional, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, you listen to your Googlers, and they're not hesitant to speak out. And one of the areas that they were particularly interested in is the one where you're using data science and coming up with innovative approaches to advance inclusion and justice for all. Tell us about that area and where you think you can make a unique contribution.
Well, inclusion and diversity is something that really undergirds every area that we focus on. So, for example, as we are thinking about skills changes and we're thinking about the future of work and we're looking at the data, we always want to ask who's going to be disproportionately impacted and who's the most vulnerable. And when you ask those kinds of questions in America, for example, you see that people of color, people in rural areas, sometimes women, you see definite patterns in terms of who's most vulnerable. And so as you think then about the solutions, you want to ask, well, what's the evidence in terms of programs that are helpful in reaching those who are most disadvantaged? And so we want to really lean into those and provide more support. So just as an example, one of the things that we've all learned, all of us who support online education, online job skills training, one of the first things that you notice is that those who actually complete are the ones who need it the least, right? So the more sort of social capital you have, you know, the higher up on the SES food chain you are, the more likely you are to complete. So we have to ask ourselves, well, what kind of wraparound services and other approaches and supportive services are needed to help all learners to get to that completion point? And so some of our grantees have been very thoughtful about how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And you, of course, help nonprofits on the front lines of global crises, both through your funding and through your volunteers. One example of that that pops to mind is a partnership you had with UNICEF around Zika. What were you able to achieve there?
Well, UNICEF has been a long and steady partner of ours. Really appreciate all the work that they're doing globally. When Zika came up, UNICEF came to us and said, you know, we would appreciate resources, of course, because, well, the engines of government will eventually get there and provide the serious, big, ongoing funding. We need some lightning funds here. But also, and more importantly, could you help us? Could you send us some data scientists? Could you help us to analyze some of the information to understand, you know, where is Zika actually most prevalent right now? And where is it headed? And so we sent a team of engineers to help them understand, look at the data, and to understand where is it now, where is it headed, where do we need to put our defenses?
You know, one other thing I wanted to ask you about is this Google Impact Challenge. And you conduct these challenges all over the world. Tell us the idea behind it.
Well, you know, it's when you think about philanthropy, there's a few models, right? So one is the proactive sort of strategic consulting model, and we do that with a lot of our work. For example, in criminal justice reform, we will go out and sort of do a landscape analysis and understand who's doing what and then think about what's the overlay with what's the most promising and where Google might have a particular advantage to come alongside a group. So that's in our proactive funding. But we also want to make sure that occasionally our model is just pretty wide open, where we go to a location and we just say, tell us how you would use innovation and say $500,000 to really change the world. So we do these impact challenges in places where we have Google offices, the places where our employees live and work. And we have found, actually, we've found a lot of our ongoing partners through these impact challenges.
Yeah. Well, I know you were always taught about humility in philanthropy, and that's really a humble approach in that we don't have all the answers. Maybe you have an answer that we hadn't thought about and that we can help run with. What's the impact of Google.org on Google and the employees? I mean, how does it change the morale, the recruitment, the retention? What does it mean to the company? Because you're doing some really interesting and fascinating things.
Yeah, I think of it as almost like a biofeedback loop, where I think, you know, we looked at data And I say this, you know, going out to all the CEOs out there and COOs out there, we looked at our data at our top talent, the kinds of folks that we were really trying to recruit, and asking them, why did you choose Google over some of the alternatives? And one of the top things that comes back is Google.org and this sense that Google has a mission.
Oh, that's great.
And that I can participate in that. And then we looked at our retention statistics of our strongest employees, same thing. So it's even, and this is interesting, it's true, even for those employees who haven't yet volunteered or taken part in a project, but even knowing that it's there and that they have the opportunity at the right time, the right season to do that. So I think that that's one way that we help contribute to the company. I think the way that Google, you know, as a company makes Google.org different from, say, just a traditional funder is that we can really think about what are the strengths of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we leverage that? I'll give you one quick example. So when the refugee crisis happened in Europe a few years back, and we saw just, you know, a million immigrants coming through and thinking about quick reactions, we were able to go out and use our platforms to say, hey, we would like to help groups like UNICEF
yeah.
and others with just, you know, very quick response, humanitarian response. And we opened that up to the public to do a matching campaign. And we were able to raise tens of millions of dollars for partners like the IRC or like UNICEF to help with just immediate humanitarian needs.
And you also matched the contributions of your employees, correct?
That's right. We matched, yeah, all of our employees get $6,000
mm-hmm.
that we match. We also give additional match in things like crisis response.
Yeah, that's like $50 million or something like that. It's a picture.
North
of
that.
Yeah, north of that, absolutely.
Well, north of that, actually.
Good. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So, well, picking up on the workplace, you're recognized as a great place to work. So, Jacqueline, how do you think of the corporate culture at Google? And is there anything that you do specifically at Google.org to help shape and influence that culture?
Well, I think one of the things we pride ourselves at Google is that we're an innovation culture.
Hmm.
And so we want to make sure that Google.org is also innovative. So part of that is thinking about making sure that we're looking at data and evidence for the solutions that we're supporting and then contributing that data and evidence back to the field.
Yeah.
So, you know, for example, a grantee like GiveDirectly, who I know you've had on the show,
mm-hmm.
we really like them both because of the work that they're doing in terms of getting resources into the hands of the poor with very low transaction fees, but also because of their transparency.
Yep.
And that culture of transparency, that culture of data and evidence that they have is very similar to Google's culture.
Yeah, they're a remarkable organization. In fact, I was talking to a fellow over there who was a PR person, and he said it was a hard adjustment for him because when things didn't go well, he was ready to spin it.
Yes.
And they were saying, no,
nope.
don't spin it.
No.
Just tell it the way it is.
Yeah.
And he's like, what?
Yeah.
Isn't that my job?
Let's just write a blog post about it. Yeah.
Exactly what happened.
We've had a little bit of fraud. Let's write a blog post on that.
Absolutely. That's so refreshing to see. Well, let me close with this, Jacqueline. Google significantly influences so many things that we look at. A lot of it has to do because of all the company has achieved, the innovations you've pioneered, the respect it commands. When it comes to corporate philanthropy, how do you believe Google.org has influenced the field?
Well, I think it's pretty early days to say whether we've had an influence. You know, one of the things that we think about is that 5% of companies, you know, contributing to the $400 billion that's privately given. And how do we increase that? Look, I don't think the way that Google.org does things is the way that every company should do things. Our philosophy is that every company should think about, you know, who are we as a company?
Mm.
What are our deepest values? What are the issues that we care about that are really aligned with our strengths? What is something that unites our employees? And what kind of assets do we bring to the table? You know, for example, is it our supply chain? Is it our advertising? Is it our voice? Is it our employees getting out into the community? Do we have resources? So I think if anything, what we'd like to contribute is to this movement among companies who are asking those questions and thinking, how can we bring the best of who we are as Google or whatever company to help take on some of these big human challenges?
Authenticity, it sounds like,
yeah.
to who you are. Well, Jacqueline Fuller, the president of Google.org, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information that you think a visitor might find to be of particular interest.
Well, we are, not surprisingly, found at Google.org. And our website contains information about some of the topics we take on, whether that's education or computer science and diversity. You can also learn about digital skills training. You can go to the Grow with Google site if you're interested in upgrading your own personal skills mm-hmm. and interested in online training. We also have these impact challenges occasionally that are open, and so you can check out that page to see if there's something going on in the places where you live.
Lots there. Well, thanks, Jacqueline. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
It has been said that 90% of success is just showing up. And while that might be a slight exaggeration, it is a big part of it, especially when it comes to school. Yet, up to one-third of student populations in high-poverty urban areas are chronically absent. When my next guest observed that, and the impact it had on things like graduation rates, she decided to do something about it. And that was to start a social venture called Kinvolved. And it's a pleasure to have with us the co-founder and CEO of Kinvolved, Miriam Altman. Good evening, Miriam, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Hi, Denver. Thanks for having me.
How did you first come to the realization that absenteeism, and especially chronic absenteeism, was such a big issue? And how serious an issue is it across the United States?
So I started my career about 10 years ago when I moved to New York City to become a public school educator. I taught in a high school for several years, and one of the first things I observed when I was teaching was that kids just weren't showing up to school consistently. I had students who would miss a day of school here and there, kids who would chronically miss first period and so always miss their history class, other students who would be absent for a couple of weeks at a time for family vacations or other more severe issues, and then just, you know, the typical high school kid who would cut class here and there. And it just was a pretty tremendous, overwhelming problem that I really saw firsthand. And of course, as anyone can expect, kids don't show up to school, just like if you don't show up to work, it's very hard to make progress, and started to really identify this as a core problem that was preventing my students from being successful.
You know, I'm sure there's no simple answer to this, Miriam, but why are students generally late or absent from class?
That's a great question, and it's interesting because now Kinvolved is starting to work in communities ranging in size and demographic. Now we're in more than 7 states, and interestingly, regardless of the differences in the geographic region and the type of district, the problems tend to be very similar. A couple of the core reasons kids tend to be absent from class are when you sort of look at the elementary school age group of students. Certainly, it's not the kids themselves who are, you know, relying on adults to bring them into school who are late or absent on their own. It's parents who are working several jobs who don't necessarily realize how quickly absenteeism adds up. Just 2 days per month of class missed means that a kid is chronically absent.
Hmm.
And even as a teacher, I never realized how quickly days could add up. And so it's critically important that in the elementary grades, we're educating parents about why it's critical to come to school. Other parents of elementary school kids sometimes won't realize what time class, you know, school starts, or they're mm-hmm. trying to get kids out the school or out the door to school in the morning. And, you know, what happens is that day over day, if students are late, they miss that first 30 or 45 minutes of the school day, and that's when they're learning their reading skills. So then if you go on for an entire school year or more where kids are just chronically late, even if they are showing up, they might fall behind very quickly in their reading levels, for example.
Asthma is a big reason for mm-hmm. kids don't show up as well, right?
Yes. So when we look at the core sort of reasons behind absenteeism, chronic illness, chronic asthma would certainly be one of those types of illnesses that really affects kids in more urban and high poverty communities. I have asthma myself, and it's never something that's prevented me from attending school. I have an inhaler that I keep with me. So when I started to learn when I was teaching that kids were missing days or even weeks on end of school because they were having attacks and didn't have the proper preventative care, it was really pretty shocking to me. Mm-hmm. And the research shows that it's not uncommon for kids to miss school for that reason. You know, other reasons that we see are pretty severe as well, oftentimes issues related to poverty. Students whose families have become homeless or become evicted from their homes. Students whose parents don't speak English and, you know, have a court date, whether it's for, you know, an eviction or something else. And so the students are whom the parents are relying on to translate for them in court. I can tell you many instances in which I saw that in my own classroom with high school students. And when we hear about that in the high schools in which we're working now. There's also some issues that have arisen more recently, unfortunately, around politics. In New York City in particular, there's been a lot of reporting around kids not feeling comfortable coming to school who are undocumented immigrants, for example. And similarly, their parents not feeling comfortable coming into the school for that same reason. And those are kind of some of the barriers that we're trying to help schools break down with families who don't necessarily feel comfortable in the school building as a starting point.
Is there a day of the week where absenteeism is highest?
That's a good question. I don't know that on a national scale nor on a New York City specific scale, but what I do know is that teachers can look at that information as well as school administrators and district administrators within our technology. You can see attendance by day of the week and really identify those trends, but there's not sort of a known day.
Not Monday.
Yeah. I would say typically, you know, probably Fridays or you know, days around long weekends, holidays and such.
Like this one.
Mm-hmm.
So you were able to take this idea, and you know how many people, Miriam, have great ideas and do nothing with them, but you acted on yours. How did Kinvolved become a reality?
So I always tell the story of one student, and she's just one of many, many kids whom I taught when I was in the classroom. And the student's name's Alexandra. Alexandra was in my class when she was in ninth grade. And within the first marking period, which is about 6 weeks of the school year, she'd already missed about half of the school days and as a result was chronically absent, of course, mm-hmm. and failing my class, which was required for graduation, as well as the other classes that she was missing, of course. And as a result of her absence, I became very concerned that she wasn't going to pass. And so I was a new teacher when I taught Alexandra. I reached out to her mother using the phone number that the school had on file. I wasn't able to get a phone call back. I was very frustrated, and I was wondering, you know, does his mother not care about her kid being successful? Mm-hmm. Why isn't she being a partner to me? And I felt really alienated, like I was the only one trying to get Alexander to come to school. But when I met Alexander's mom at parent-teacher night at the end of that first marking period, that's when I realized that my presumptions about her mother, as well as about many other parents, were totally, you know, invalidated. And that was because when her mother showed up to the parent-teacher night, she received the printout of the report card. And that was the first time, 6 weeks in the school year, if you can imagine, as a parent, that she saw the number of days that her daughter had missed school and the corresponding failing grades in every single class. And when I met Alexander's mother, first of all, she came to the conferences with a couple of her other children. So she had several kids that she was, you know, caring for. I learned that she didn't speak English as a native language. She was a Spanish speaker. And that her phone number had changed because she, you know, had a pay-as-you-go phone and she changed the number and the school never got the new number. This is a very common story, which is why I tell it all the time. So it was only because her mother and I had this sort of chance in engagement where we met at these teacher conferences, and I speak a little bit of Spanish, that I was able to save her mother's phone number, her new phone number, my phone, and I started just texting her and constantly following up with her, you know, texting in Spanish. Alexander made it to school. This is the homework. These kinds of communications. And almost instantly, really within the next week, Alexander's attendance improved. She ended up graduating from high school, and she graduated from college about 2 years ago now.
Great.
So while that's an amazing success story.
Yeah, but it's only one.
It's only one. That's exactly right. And so I always, you know, people love hearing that story and I love to tell it. And there are others like that. But unfortunately, when I went back to the graduation for Alexandra and her classmates who had been in my class in ninth grade, only about 50% of the kids who'd started ninth grade were walking across the stage on that graduation day. And unfortunately, that's not at all dissimilar from many mm-hmm. statistics we see, you know, citywide in New York, as well as on a national scale and the type of communities where many of our students come from. So that's when I really started thinking. I was in graduate school at the time. I was in my first year at the Wagner School at NYU,
right,
studying policy. I thought I wanted to start a school. That's what I wrote my application essay about. So I had the entrepreneurial bug already, mm-hmm. but it wasn't necessarily that I imagined developing a solution to this absenteeism problem. But, you know, thinking about what the greatest challenges were when I was teaching, going back to that graduation day and realizing how many kids that we really could have changed the course of their lives if I'd had more interactions with their families and gotten on the same page with them, as was in the instance of Alexandra, I really felt that there was a tremendous gap and barriers that we could break down that would get kids to come to school and therefore help them shift their path so that they would be more likely to be successful in the short and the long term.
And it turns out you found another Alexandra
at
Wagner School, who turned out to be your co-founder.
Indeed. Yes. My co-founder, Alex, as we call her, is our chief product officer. And Alex and I met in actually the very first event that we had at Wagner. Over a glass of wine, there was, a professor and student mixer like the day before school started. And we happened to start chatting and knew a few people in common, as it turned out, had a few classes together and started to become friends and also work together, which is important if you're thinking about starting a business. And found that we had a lot of complementary backgrounds and experiences. While I was in the classroom, Alex had been working in the hospital, mm-hmm. Bronx Lebanon, up in the South Bronx, developing a parent support group. So she really saw, while I was seeing the classroom perspective, the perspective of parents that she was working with, and how little information that they had about their children's progress in school and how deeply they wanted to be involved and didn't really know where to start.
Yeah, very nice set of complementary backgrounds and skills. Mm-hmm. Well, Kinvolved is built around the Kinvo app. So how does this app work? What does a teacher do and what happens?
So in every district outside of New York City, New York is a little bit different. The way that we work is that we actually plug directly into the district student information system, which is the system of record that every school district is mandated to use, where teachers input attendance data. Sometimes it's a technology. In New York City, it's these bubble sheets or mm-hmm. these sort of Scantron forms. But essentially, what we've been able to do is build direct integrations into each of these systems, regardless of the system that the district uses. And we read the attendance data that the teachers have input into their system of record and kind of operate on the back end, making that actionable in two ways. One is that we send translated in about 65 different languages, translated text message, as well as email and robocall, but really focusing on text messages because that's the type of communication that everyone uses.
Yeah, for sure.
We send notifications to families based on the attendance data about their students' attendance on a daily basis. And then parents can actually receive a text message, respond in, let's say, Haitian Creole, if that's their native language, and it'll translate back into English and go directly to the main point of contact. An attendance clerk typically is what they're called within a school, who typically, you might imagine, kind of mans the phones mm-hmm. in the main office. Now they are cutting 5 or more hours per day of their time on the phones, just gathering this information via text message so that they can really refocus their efforts on deeper interventions for kids who are more than just sick that day or, had a death in the family. Those kids who really have more chronic issues, they can focus their time there. So that's the first way that the technology mm-hmm. enables the attendance data to be actionable. Secondly, we capture quite a bit of data that's really informative and put it into reports that existing systems really don't offer, that enables school-based teams, usually called attendance teams or administrative teams or district-level teams, to really identify which kids are missing school, which days, for which reasons, and inform interventions that are based on data rather than sort of throwing everything at mm-hmm. the wall and seeing what sticks, which is what we've found a lot of districts are trying to do now as they've discovered this problem.
Is attendance generally taken at the beginning of the day, or is it taken during every class period?
For elementary schools, it's typically taken close to the beginning of the day. For high schools, it's typically taken every class period, but that varies a bit depending on the city and the state's requirements.
And do these text messages just go to the parents or guardians, or are other people getting them as well?
That's a great question. So the name people ask us, in fact, one of our users that we had in our office yesterday asked us about the name Kinvolved and where that came from. And the idea behind the name is kin, like the kinship network,
mm-hmm.
realizing from our experiences working directly with families that it's not just parents who need to be informed. often. It's that student support network and building that network around students. So it can be grandparents. It could be older brothers and sisters, cousins, basketball coaches, you know, big brothers, big sisters, people who are authorized to receive communications. There could be up to 10 per student who are part of that network receiving information via text message about attendance as well as other topics. It's not just communications limited to attendance.
Yeah, tell me about some of those other topics. What are the other capabilities of this app?
Indeed. So the technology really, again, you know, started with a focus on reducing absenteeism and informing parents about attendance and absenteeism. But what we found is that research proves that there is a huge potential if we communicate more positive information consistently with families, that can be what we call a tier one intervention that just starts by laying the foundation, creating a welcoming, warm culture in the school where kids who are already attending school want to continue to come back. So it's preventative in nature, as well as trying to pull kids back in who start to kind of fall off track.
Mm-hmm.
When kids feel like they're wanted, when families feel like they're welcome, and that's enabled through positive communications and text messaging as a starting point, we find that the school and the district really has that foundation to ensure that fewer kids fall off track in the first place. So we've become an all-encompassing communications tool.
Yeah.
So everyone from the teacher in the classroom to the school principal who wants to send a message about parent-teacher nights, for example, to even now district-level leadership that need to send emergency alerts about a snow day or something of that nature can use the technology as their main system of communication. And everyone gets on the same tool, which is great for parents because it lends to consistency. It's awesome for school-based leadership because they have sort of oversight over the communications to ensure that they're safe and secure. And what you have now in a lot of districts is teachers using sort of their own phones like I did,
mm-hmm.
or individual apps that really, the quality control is very difficult to manage.
Very haphazard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I would imagine this level of communication really just changes the nature of the relationship between the parent and the school, and probably the school can even ascertain some of the problems maybe that the child is having at home that they would otherwise not know, and then can sort of direct them to some community resources or referrals.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Was this a challenge for you and your co-founder? Neither one of you were technologists, and you built a company based on a software app. How did you navigate those tricky waters?
That's a really great question. And now that we've been doing this for about 6 years, we have had the opportunity to think back on some of the challenges that we've experienced.
I wonder why you did it in the first place, right?
Sometimes I wonder, but you know, when we hear the stories of the impact of the work that we're doing and the relationships we've developed and sustained over the years, it's really all worth it. But yes, indeed, neither of us had technology backgrounds. That was definitely a sticking point for funders earlier on who were really concerned about lack of technical talent on the team. But I would say that both my co-founder, Alex, who's our chief product officer and works directly with our technical team, as well as on the implementation of the software with our school districts, and myself, I don't have a business background. I didn't go to business school. Mm-hmm. I started as a teacher in the classroom and have a policy degree. You know, I learned to fundraise. I learned to develop a business model that, you know, we're a revenue-generating company.
Just get stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And it's a fun, for us, it's been a fun challenge to identify those weaknesses and figure out ways to self-teach. So to answer your question, we were able to build a technology. It was a little bumpy at first, to be very honest. We went through a few different, you know, technical teams.
Sure.
We learned things along the way. I don't think that any of the money that we spent on building the technology early on was money wasted, because it really was all in the spirit of learning. And we were able to get results, you know, all the way through. We had pilots that started, and we've had that same school that we started with since 2013. But over time, you know, Alex in particular really learned how to manage a technical team. We've had some really incredible advisors who spend way more time than they ever should be required to, but just because they're great people and saw the potential in Alex and in our team and in our product and the mission, spend a lot of time with us, really training us up in how to build a product and how to manage a product roadmap, taking user feedback consistently, which is critically important. And we're always improving and always iterating. It's not a finished product, and it never will be.
That's good. And you've also enriched what you do by helping schools create a culture of attendance. And one of the things you're doing in this regard are your professional services. What are those professional services comprised of?
So when we started Convolved, again, I think based on my experience in the classroom based on Alex's experience in the community working with parents. I use technology in my classroom, some probably more limited than what's out there now. But I always knew that just giving teachers a technology did not mean it was going to be used, and it didn't mean that it was going to be used in the way that that we Convolved as an organization's mission-driven really intended. If we just gave the technology to some teachers, not all, but to some, the traditional sort of culture has been to use communications tools for negative communications with families. And that's exactly the reverse effect that we want to see, right? We want families to ultimately feel welcome in the school, to feel like they're a partner. And that takes coaching and training. You know, again, just giving someone a tool without guidance on how to use it and implement it strategically, when you're really trying to create change and cultural shift in an industry like the education industry, you really need to make sure people are equipped with the information that they need to use it effectively. So professional services, also called professional development is a common term in education, are both virtual and in person. And we have sort of different packages which we offer that range in basically the level of service that a district wants. Essentially, we go and we work with the district team on the implementation and think about it strategically, both from a technical implementation perspective, as well as from sort of a strategic perspective in terms of policy. What policies do they already have in place? Mm-hmm. What might they want to implement? What are their main goals? And how can this software within the other systems that they may be using and the other policies that they may be promoting, where does this fit in most effectively and what do we really want to highlight? Plus then, you know, how do we roll it out most effectively? Typically, we don't roll out district-wide right away unless it's a fairly small district. You know, we want it to be sort of staged and stepped out so that there's opportunities to learn along the way before kind of doing a full-blown rollout. So those are some of the examples of professional services that we offer.
Well, you recently came out with your 2016-2017 impact report. So what has this all meant in terms of reducing absenteeism and having students in their seats for more hours during the school day?
So what we know is that when we've looked at publicly available data, so not just data that we're capturing and, you know, using to our own interests, but really looking at publicly available data that cities, specifically New York, in the case of that report, put out, we know that the schools with which we work, first of all, enroll higher demographics of students who are dealing with more challenges, typically, yeah. Right? Students who are living below the poverty line, who qualify for free reduced lunch, who are what we call English language learners, so don't speak English as a native language. And, you know, typically students of color. And, you know, again, compared with even the average city school, our schools are enrolling higher populations in each of those areas. And so they're, you know, facing more adversity in some instances than the typical DOE school. But despite those challenges and that adversity, the schools with which we work have improved attendance at a rate that is about 13 times better than the average New York City school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, the most significant improvement we've seen is among high schools, but we've seen improvement as well among the middle schools as well as elementary schools in average daily attendance. What we also know, and it's new data that we didn't have in previous years, is that chronic absenteeism of our schools is much lower than that of the city's average school. So while the city saw, unfortunately, a pretty significant increase in chronic absence last year, the schools with which we work saw a much lesser increase in chronic absenteeism. So it's first about sort of, it's like stopping the bleeding,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
And then starting to work to bring it down. And that's what we're doing in districts, you know, like Providence Public Schools and others across the country that have seen similar trends of upward chronic absence.
You are not a nonprofit organization, but a social venture, a C corporation. Tell us a little bit about how you structured your company and your business model, where your funding comes from and how you generate your income.
Yeah, so we are an incredibly mission-driven organization. You know, our backgrounds, the people that we hire in our team, the school districts with which we work, and the students that we really want to help serve. It's really to us about equity. Not all education technology is designed to close gaps,
mm-hmm.
in some cases inadvertently or maybe advertently. It actually increases gaps between students who are of means and students who are not. And we are really, really determined to close those gaps. But that said, we did do a lot of investigation early on in the development of the company to figure out whether we should be a nonprofit or a for-profit. It really was a question, and we did a lot of research,
yeah.
Like I said. And we decided to become a for-profit, largely because the main product that we offer and our main revenue-generating source is technology. And you can, as a nonprofit, own technology, but it's less, much less frequent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first reason. And the second reason was that we really wanted to build a product that was reliant upon our customer base. We wanted our customers and our revenues as a result to really drive the development of the company rather than potential, you know, philanthropic funding that might have different goals that were slightly outside of the mission or the needs of the user. And so we did decide to incorporate as a C corporation, but we also were the first, I think, ed tech company to become a certified benefit corporation.
Right.
That was way back in 2013. Mm-hmm. We've been recertified several times since then.
What does a product cost for a school or a school district? And I'm sure there's a big variation based on the size and other things of that nature.
It's very competitively priced and it is an annual license per student that really ranges depending on the sort of type of the software or the functionality of the software. We have a couple of different versions of the Kinvo app that districts can purchase.
And speaking of competition, do you have any competition?
A great question. Certainly, the education technology market is a crowded one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's consolidating to some degree. When we think of competition, there are sort of three different types of products that are out there. First are the student information systems. And I mentioned those earlier. And those are sort of broad tools that encompass and collect a number of different data points, ranging from attendance to grades to parent contact information and other many other data points. And actually, instead of competing with those systems, which is what we experienced earlier on in the company's life cycle, we've now built direct integrations with many of them so that we can pull their data and really enhance it for the benefit of the district. You know, student information systems are used broad, you know, for broad data collection. They're not really intended to improve attendance. And so that's really the narrow focus that we've mm-hmm. established. The second group of sort of competitors that we think of are district level mass communication systems, for example, like the robocalling systems when there's a snow day. And typically those systems are pretty limited in that they're not accessible to teachers. So teachers have to find their own tools to use and they don't enable two-way communication for the most part. So parents can't respond. It's not an engagement tool. It's a broadcasting tool. So in many districts, we've actually been able to replace those tools by offering the same functionality and much more at a pretty competitive price. And then the third bucket would be individual teacher tools.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, you know, sort of Silicon Valley type individual apps that teachers will download and they're really awesome to use fall short when it comes to district level oversight. And districts are becoming increasingly concerned about the safety and security of communications as a result.
Let me ask your opinion on something. Having been around this area for such a long time, I mean, thousands of children, hundreds of thousands of school hours and class periods. Do you have any thoughts on the school day itself, the hours of the school day, and also the duration of the school year?
It's an interesting question because I think that the traditional school model, generally speaking, is pretty, you know, antiquated. And I think that there are many efforts that, you know, I followed to change up the way that school exists.
Mm.
And we hope that as those models take root and become more common, you know, attendance, whether it's virtual attendance or, you know, in-person attendance at a job site or wherever that is will be important. So there'll still be a place for Kinvolved. And we're really excited to see where the industry grows and adapt to that. But for now, you know, mostly it's brick and mortar schools.
Yeah.
I know that the school in which I taught had the latest start time in the city. It was 9 a.m. and then we went a little bit later in the day. And I think that that was really good for high school students. However, once kids know that the day is shifted back later, then kids who would have been late, you know, when it started at 8 a.m. now become late when it starts at 9 a.m. So it's sort of about mindset, mindset shifts. The other thing I would say, however, though, is that when we're thinking about reasons for absenteeism and lateness, transportation, especially in big cities, and New York is not excluded from this, is a core reason for lateness and absence. And so when kids are commuting, especially in New York, again, from long distances because they're placed in high schools all over the city, it is helpful to them when the school day starts a little bit later.
Yeah. Let me close with this, Miriam. What's next for Kinvolved? I mean, what new markets are you looking at and what other enhancements are you contemplating to have even a greater impact?
So it's been a really exciting time for Kinvolved. We really got our start in New York City, right in our own backyard. We expanded pretty organically, starting with a couple of pilots in the 13-14 school year, growing that pilot in the 14-15 school year. And then 15-16 is really when we considered to have launched. And by the end of that school year, we had 40 schools in New York that were using the product. By the end of the 16-17 school year, We had more than 100 schools in New York City using the product, and that number has continued to grow. We're in about 150 New York City schools. The thing that's really exciting about the last year is that it was the first time in which we really grew outside of New York City, and we were able to get into districts that really ranged in size from, you know, more suburban districts that still had challenges with absenteeism that were more like 10,000 students, all the way up to, you know, large districts like Providence Public Schools, for example, where we just launched a district-wide partnership over the last several months. So when we think about what the future holds, you know, there's a huge need nationally. We are tackling this problem in a really unique way, and we also have 6 years of work under our belts, you know, observing what the needs are in the community and following policy that's now making this more of a forefront issue. And we want to expand within the states that we're already working in and really, again, sort of get that network or that community effect. But we also, you know, hope to be in all 50 states and even, you know, have an international presence. We get a ton of international inbound interest that we just haven't yet felt like
you got your arms
we're
around
ready
yet.
Yeah. to
Got
to
keep
attack.
On walking before you run. Yeah, well, it's just wonderful when you think about all the things we're trying to do to improve the education system in this country. Nothing much more foundational than having people show up for school. Well, Miriam Altman, the CEO of Kinvolved, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the things visitors will find on it.
Thanks, Denver. So our website is www.kinvolved, which is spelled KINVOLVED.com. On our website, you can find information all about the services that we provide. You can hear quotes from and videos from some of our users, download our impact report, as well as our guide to family partnerships, which is our recent ebook that we put out that's based on our learnings and the districts that we've worked with for the last 6 years. You can also sign up to learn more about how to bring the Kinvo app, as well as our other services, to your school or your district by going to, again, www.kinvolved.com. And we'll look forward to hearing from you.
Well, thanks, Miriam. It was great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Brandy McHale, the president of the Citibank Foundation, and Terry Fulmer, president of the John Harford Foundation, which is dedicated to improving the care of older adults. Thanks for listening. Have a great first week of September, and do come back next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.